Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars. I'm gonna give you my heart. Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars. Cause you light up the path.
Spend more and more time staring down at our mobile phones, it's easy to forget there are vast galaxies above us. Big corporates are sending thousands of satellites into space for the sake of better communication on Earth. While this may sound exciting, each launch leaves a trail of satellites, rocket parts, and space junk floating over our heads. In the coming decade, we will see more satellites launched than in all of history. As rocket launches become cheaper, upwards of 100,000 satellites could orbit Earth, forever changing our dark, starry skies. I'm Katerina Badzaiki, and in this week's infinitely curious program of Earth's Voice of Greece, we will explore how the wonder of gazing the night sky is rapidly changing because of our quest to be connected, and how the sun, becomes our biggest source of life and health. In the hallways of the United Nations, 102 countries are busy debating the future of what is called the Outer Space Treaty. The treaty was established in 1967, almost a decade after the then Soviet Union launched the first human-made object into space, Sputnik 1. It was a moment that changed the world. Since then, commercial interest in space has grown astronomically. In 66 years, we've sent up about 11,000 objects in space, says international law expert Stephen Freeland. In the next 10 years, we will see somewhere between 100,000 and 500,000 more objects, so you're making an increasingly hazardous area even more hazardous by having so many more objects in space, he added. Fiori Medalinu has a bachelor's degree in physics and a master's degree in atmospheric and environmental physics and holds a PhD in the development and attenuation of magnetic storms in geospace. She works at the National Observatory of Athens, where she lectures and writes about astronomy and space physics, often inviting students and the public to gaze at our galaxy through the observatory's telescopes. Fiori, hello and welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you very much for being with you.
I want to start by asking you, why do so many humans like gazing at the stars, you think, when this is something that is so far and distant from us?
Okay, the view of the night sky, it has always been so attractive and romantic, so we're all captured by the image of the night sky. Additionally, the myths from our mythology, not only the Greek mythology, but from all over the world, all these myths are projected on the celestial sphere through the constellations. So we give the names of the constellations like Orion, the Big Dipper, Scorpio, Perseus, Andromeda, and so on. So there is a connection between the Earth and the sky through the mythology. And this is also very inspiring to see that all our mythology is projected on the night sky. On the other hand, the research in astrophysics, astronomy, and space physics becomes so impressive. So everybody, I think most of the people, get very impressed by observing, studying all the achievements of humans in space.
We know that space, though, is becoming ever more crowded now with satellites, particularly in areas that we know is low Earth orbit, somewhere between 500 kilometers to about 1,000 kilometers or so above the Earth. How visible and how dangerous are they?
Okay, you're absolutely right. During these last 56 years after the Sputnik launch in 1967, the humans have launched hundreds of satellites orbiting around the Earth. Of course, this is very useful for the humans in order to observe our planet, to observe the heavens for research and astrophysics, but it also produces lots of space debris. Because the remnants of the satellites that are not used anymore, they are still orbiting around the Earth, and many of them, they fall down as they are destroyed, producing several damages, not only to satellites, but they end in many ways down on the Earth. So we need to take care of our space environment, the near Earth space environment, in order to be safe and finally not to pollute our environment. So the satellites, after they have been used, they have to be driven and returned back to the Earth on the ground safely, safe for us. And of course, the satellites that they are still in orbit around our planet, they also produce light pollution, annoying, of course, the observers, the amateur, and the professional astronomers. So I think that we have to take much care of these phenomena on near-Earth space.
Speaking of light pollution, the World Atlas of Artificial Night Sky Brightness also found as much as 99% of Europeans and the population of, say, the United States live under light-polluted skies, which is why many people in metropolitan cities do not experience darkness. How close is Greece to that data?
Okay, fortunately, in Greece and generally in Eastern Europe, we have the advantage to have a really dark skies. Apart from the big cities like Athens or Thessaloniki or the biggest cities in Greece, there are many places in our islands, on the mountains, that we can observe nicely the night sky. So we are lucky to be in this place and to live in Greece, but of course we need to take care of our night skies in order to keep them and to remain as dark as they are today or as they used to be decades before. So if you would like to get informed about the light pollution at several places around the globe, the International Dark Sky Association is responsible for informing us about this phenomenon. So this association has certified several parks across Europe that they really have dark skies and they are appropriate for stargazing. And of course in Greece, I'm coming back to Greece, in Peloponnese, Crete, on Epirus, there are still many places with dark skies. And of course the amateur astronomers and the professional astronomers in Greece and from abroad, they're visiting our country in order to observe. And they have meetings under the night skies in order to observe, to take astrophotos of the night skies. So we still do have this advantage.
So you mean there's a stargazing tourism as well in Greece?
Yes, let's say astro-tourism.
Mm-hmm. With the rate of the moon, however, moving further and further away from us at a rate of 3 centimetres a year, combined with city light pollution, do you think future generations may not be able to see it anymore?
Okay, a future, in astronomical way of speaking, is very, very far from us and our lives because the astronomical scales in time and space, of course, they're huge. And of course, the moon, as you said before, is drifting away from Earth because it has been pulled by our planets because of the gravitational force. And as a result, as the moon moves little by little away from the Earth, during the next billions of years, in astronomy, it's not such a long time, but for the humans, it's very, very distant time in the future. What is going to happen is that the length of the day will get longer as a result of this movement of the moon. You can imagine that 2.5 billion years ago, the day lasted shorter. It was 17 hours instead of 24 that it is nowadays. And another effect of this gravitational movement of the moon is that most of the cold and warm currents that they flow at the oceans on our planet won't exist anymore. And as a result, we are going to have death of large number of species. But this is an effect very far in the future, so I think we don't need to worry that much about this phenomenon of the drifting of the moon.
When visitors come to the Athens Observatory, what is the first thing they want to see?
We organize day tours for school children, so we have to schedule the schools and the children that they're going to visit us. And apart from the day tours, we have night star gazing 3 times a week, every Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday evening. There are tours in Greek and in English. During the summertime, the Greek tour starts at 8 o'clock and the English one at 9. So we go around the historical premises of the observatory, we visit the museum where a visitor may see several instruments, historical instruments and telescopes, of course, of the previous 2 centuries, a very exceptional lunar map made by a German astronomer Julius Schmidt, and a modern replica of the Antikythera mechanism, this old instrument made of gears that was able to predict and to give us information about the position of the sun and the moon, the phases of the moon, the eclipses, and several other astronomical phenomena. So after visiting the museum, we proceed and we conclude by observing the heavens, the stars, the planets, the moon, whatever is appropriate for observing during that night, on the hill of Pnyx, where a telescope is located. It is called Voridis telescope, and through this telescope, the visitor has the experience to observe the night sky from the center of Athens. Of course, the center of Athens is very much polluted, but still, we're able to have a nice observation because the telescope is a very accurate and a very nice instrument. So we give our visitors the opportunity to observe the night sky and to look up the sky and realize that the stars are above us, forming the constellations, the planets are there, the moon is there. So I strongly suggest this nice experience.
Solar eclipses are events that people are willing to cross oceans and continents for. I mean, I'm sure you have actually seen a solar eclipse or a moon eclipse. Why is that, when in many cultures they are associated with bad omens? And is it true that in 10 or 20,000 years from now, we may never have solar eclipses again?
Okay, right. Okay, the solar and the lunar eclipses, of course, they're very exceptional and very impressive phenomena to be observed during our lives. Of course, the eclipses are observed because their relative position and the sizes of the moon, the earth, and the sun are such as that they permit one object to cover absolutely, totally the other. So when we observe a solar eclipse, the moon is passing between the earth and the sun, and the solar disk is totally covered by the area of the moon. So we do observe a total solar eclipse. This is not going to happen after many, many years, after millions of years, because the distances of these three objects are changing. Slightly, but constantly, they change. So we live in a period of the history of our solar system that the positions of these three objects permit us to observe total solar and lunar eclipses, as people used to observe thousands of years before. The Antikythera mechanism was a mechanism constructed 2,000 years before in order to predict the eclipses, and it was able to predict the eclipses precisely. So I strongly suggest, of course, to everybody to be able to observe an eclipse. So there are people traveling all over the world. They're called the eclipse hunters in order to observe an eclipse. This year, just 2 weeks before, friends of ours, amateur and professional astronomers, they had traveled to Australia in order to observe a total solar eclipse. Next year, we're going to observe such an eclipse from the U.S., from Texas, from Mexico as well. So every year, there is a place on the planet appropriate for observing an eclipse. So we need to travel in order to observe the eclipses. And this is a very nice habit, to travel around the globe in order to observe a unique phenomenon.
When was the last time a solar eclipse was visible from Greece?
From Greece? It was in 2006. It was visible from Castellorizo, this small island in south and east of Greece, close to Rhodes. There were so many people gathered there, not only from Greece, but from all over the world. The next one, it's going to take place in 2084, if I remember right. So it's very far in the future. So instead of waiting to observe an eclipse from Greece, it's better for us to travel.
Mm-hmm. And lunar eclipse?
Lunar eclipses are taking place more frequently, so we are able to observe several lunar eclipses. And if such a phenomenon is visible, we organize open nights at the observatory in Athens at Physion Visitor Center, where I work as well, and people are invited to observe the eclipses. We have our telescope. We also use portable telescopes on the Hill of Pnyx, having a wonderful view of Acropolis, of the Hill of Acropolis. We collaborate with amateur astronomers, amateur astronomical clubs all over Greece, so they are joining us in order to use their equipment for observing. So it's a very nice opportunity to observe the eclipses.
When do you foresee the next lunar eclipse?
Oh, I'm not sure when it's going to be observed, but it's a quite frequent phenomenon. But the next solar eclipse is the one that personally I'm waiting for, and I hope to travel to Texas this time for observing this total solar eclipse.
I hope I'll join you.
Oh, okay. It will be a pleasure to travel together.
Thank you, Fiori. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Katerina. Thank you all.
And that was astrophysics scientist Fiori Metallinou. Indigenous Australians knew about solar eclipses, they spoke about them, and they kept them on record in their stories. Given these things happen on average 400 years apart, it's kind of an incredible thing that that information can make its way through so many generations and still survive.
Lately, I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. But baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars, we'll be counting stars. Yeah, we'll be counting stars. Like a swinging vine, swing my heart across the line. In my face is flashing signs. Seek it out and ye shall find. Old, but I'm not that old. Young, but I'm not that bold. And I don't think the world is sold. I'm just doing what we're told. Kills me, makes me feel alive. Lately, I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. Baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars. Watch it burn. Old, but I'm not that old. Young, but I'm not that bold. And I don't think the world is sold. I'm just doing what we're told. And I feel something so wrong. We're doing the right thing. I could lie, could lie, could lie. Everything that drowns me makes me wanna fly. I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. But baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars, we'll be counting stars. Lately, I've been
burn, sink in the river, the lessons I learned. Take that money, watch it burn, sink in the river, the lessons I learned. Take that money, watch it burn, sink in the river, the lessons I learned. Take that money, watch it burn, sink in the river, the lessons I learned.
Everything that kills me makes me feel alive.
Yeah, I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. Baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars, we'll be counting stars.
The sun is God, the artist J.M.W. Turner said on his deathbed. Cultures throughout human history have agreed. Monuments from Stonehenge to Mayan pyramids testify to that. It's not difficult to see why we have attributed divinity to the sun. The sun brings life to our planet and light to our lives. It regulates the days and the seasons and has helped to form mountains, plains, oceans and deserts. Jones, a geneticist at University College London, in his book Here Comes the Sun, points out how our local star emits more energy than we humans have managed to generate since our ancestors first learned how to light a fire. The rays of sunlight that strike our Earth have made quite a journey to get to us. They consist of vast numbers of elementary particles known as photons, which spend on average 200,000 years careering about the sun's fiery core before they reach its surface. The trip to Earth then takes 8 minutes and 20 seconds.
We like to think, of course, that having extremely hot weather, in that we don't experience it very, very much, is, generally speaking, a good thing. However, the culture in Sydney, and indeed in many parts of the tropical world, is exactly the opposite. They're concerned about hot weather on the grounds of health. Particularly, they're concerned about the effects of ultraviolet light on skin cancer, which is certainly true. This effect of sunlight on skin cancer was in fact discovered in the 1930s by a huge survey done by the United States Navy. And the United States Navy was concerned about the health of its sailors in relation to the general population. So they did this big and well-planned survey of life and death and disease incidence in Navy personnel. And they found, indeed, that there was an increase in skin cancer among sailors compared to people who worked on land. And sailors, of course, are generally much more exposed to the sun than people who work in offices and so on land. And that became very well established and is true. I don't deny it. Okay. However, what was also established by that discovery was, in fact, that if you looked at other cancers in the United States sailors, they had fewer cancers than average. And that's been forgotten. It's not been forgotten, but it certainly hasn't reached the public mind. So what's the public know about skin, ultraviolet light is that it's bad for you. And if you look at what the experts say, Cancer Research UK said, how the sun and UV cause cancer. The American Cancer Society writes about UV radiation, the dangers of skin cancer, skin cancer facts, statistics, skincancer.org. Okay, that's all right. And what they're basically telling us is that sunlight is dangerous. Well, sunlight is dangerous in some ways. But what they should be telling us, they should, on balance, it's really good for you.
Joseph Goebbels' 1938 scheme was to make Edinburgh the summer capital of a defeated Britain and the widening gap in the life expectancy of Scottish men compared to that of other European men brought on by that nation's cloudy climate. Steve Jones describes the city of Edinburgh as a fascinating demographic case study.
There are a few places, Stockholm, for example, Murmansk, but very few. And in fact, only about 2% of the world's population lives north of Edinburgh and Glasgow. And in fact, only about 1% of the world's population lives north of the Shetland Isles. So, they're really fairly unique in their position. It's also the case that Edinburgh, and Glasgow more than Edinburgh, has the joys of the Gulf Stream, which brings in even more cloud. Okay. Well, Edinburgh's position means that it gets less sunshine, because when the sun comes in to a northern part of the world or a southern part of the world, then it has to pass through more of the atmosphere, so it's attenuated more as it comes through. The sun is never directly above you that far north, but it is, of course, it is directly above you in the equation. If you look at Europe, you'll see that the effect, again, is very strong. Now, Scotland, in fact, has a famously low life expectancy. But Scotland as a whole doesn't do all that well. We go to India, Colton had life expectancy on the average is lower than that of Indian men. We go all the way through to the average of the UK for men, 77. And then we've got to go to the right, and there's a place called Lenzie. And Lenzie is an outer Glasgow suburb, 5 miles from Colton. Britain and Somalia have a 28-year difference in male life expectancy. Lenzie and Colton have a 28-year difference in life expectancy. So over 5 miles, we've got 28-year difference in life expectancy. Now, this has always historically been thought, and no doubt, Scotland is the sick man of Europe. And if you look at some of the particular causes of death, Scotland is worse than England from MS, cancer, heart disease, rickets, infectious disease, birth defects, depression, suicide, and more. And the effects aren't small. The effects are really quite big. For example, if you look at the suicide rates in Scotland and England, let's look at men who are much more likely to commit suicide, you'll see that the Scottish rate, the pale blue line, is almost twice the English rate. And the same is true for things like heart disease. So the effects are big. So one needs to ask, why is that? It has to do in particular with vitamin D deficiency. But vitamin D isn't really a vitamin at all. Vitamin D is in fact a hormone. It's made in the skin, made in large amounts in the skin, when sunlight strikes a relative of cholesterol, and it makes a precursor which then moves to the kidneys and the liver and is turned into this stuff, vitamin D. Okay, and you can get it from your food. You can get it from fresh fish. You can get it from a pill if you want to. You get it from fortified foods, which we don't have many of in Britain. They do in the United States. But overwhelmingly, you get it from sunlight. You know? If you expose your whole body for 20 minutes to bright sunlight, you'll get 10,000 units of vitamin D, which would involve eating about 25 helpings of fresh salmon, which you probably wouldn't particularly succeed in holding down, I don't think. So sunlight is an extraordinarily powerful source of vitamin D. So we need to ask, what are the patterns of sunlight across the world, and what are the patterns of vitamin D presence, and what, if anything, do these do to human health? So a bit outside the tropics, people can synthesize vitamin D all year round. Okay, in the pale yellow zone, there's at least 1 month a year, and often more than 1 month a year, where you cannot synthesize vitamin D for enough. And if you draw a line through Birmingham, and many people wish to draw a line through Birmingham, north of that line, you can never synthesize enough vitamin D to stay healthy. And Edinburgh, you can't make vitamin D for something like 8 months of the year. As you go south to London, that you gain something from that, but as you go further south to Marrakesh, things change completely. So the effect is really quite big. I was talking about white people making vitamin D, because people with dark skins, either of Asian origin or African origin, are much less able to make vitamin D than people with light skins, for obvious reasons. They have melanin pigment in their skin, which keeps the ultraviolet light out. And indeed, it is very much the case that sunlight related diseases are much more common in Britain, for example, among people of Afro-Caribbean origin or among people of Indian origin than people of European origin. So this is why did this happen? Well, in fact, the light skins of Europeans evolved in response to a shortage of sunlight. Because as we moved out of Africa, something like 80,000 years ago, and began to move across Europe, quite recently the move across Europe, it really didn't get to Western Europe in any numbers until about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Individuals who had relatively light skin, as they moved into the cloudy horrors of the north, tended to survive rather better than individuals with dark skin, so they reproduced more effectively, and so the light skin genes became more common. What happens if you don't have enough vitamin D? Well, as you probably know, you get rickets. And rickets was once universally known as the English disease. It was described in the 17th century by an English medical student, or an English doctor, who submitted a PhD to the University of Leiden. The PhD was 5 pages long. Oh, my God. As I say about modern PhDs, well, we don't read them, but we sure as hell weigh them. but his was only 5 pages long, but he gave a very precise description of rickets, and he said that the people here call it the English disease. And it was the English disease and the Scottish disease because it was much, much rarer in southern Europe. And rickets is a very nasty disease, which was very common remarkably recently. Okay, and the oldest case that we know of rickets is here. It's strangely enough, but not by coincidence, it's in a Scottish woman whose bones were found on the island of Tiree in the west of Scotland. And she had a severe case of rickets, and that almost certainly is due to a very poor diet. And one of the strange things about a lot of island people in Scotland, historically and indeed elsewhere, is that they don't fish. If you eat lots and lots of oily fish, then you're going to be okay. But it seems to be widespread that when farmers get to island communities, make an island community, they farm, they don't fish. And so she had a very poor intake from her diet. And of course, it was northern and cold. And so she got rickets and without question died of it. That was true of many other groups at that page, of that period too. But it's become more and more clear that vitamin D is important in all kinds of other parts of the body. As I said, it's a hormone. And if you look at the cells of any part of the body, every single part of the body has got receptor cells onto which this hormone can actually latch. They're in the brain, they're in the heart, they're in the liver, they're in the kidney, they're in the muscles, they're everywhere, okay? And you can see these are just some of the conditions we know are associated with low levels of vitamin D. And this is just a kind of a general statement without figures, but you can see that vitamin D is really all pervasive throughout the body, and if you have no levels of it, perhaps because you get no sunlight, then you have you're a danger in many, many different ways. And there was a sun cure was already widespread. And the sun cure came from the belief that the sun, for reasons then unknown, could cure tuberculosis. And in fact, R.L. Stevenson, who died of tuberculosis in the 19th century, quite young, 44, I think he was, he took the sun cure in California, and but it was too late for him. The evidence that it cured tuberculosis was then rather weak, but it was known, it cured another infectious disease called lupus. Scientists who discovered that ultraviolet lights would cure this, just cure it. It wouldn't just improve it, it would cure it. And in the beginning of the 20th century, something like 2 or 3% of the population were afflicted with this really, really awful disease, which often showed they had TB as well. But this ultraviolet cured it. It cures it because it kills bacteria. Ultraviolet is, as you know, if you sterilize, one of the ways you sterilize lamp bottles and the like, and sterilize water when you drink it, is to use ultraviolet light, and it's very, very powerful. Bacteria find it hard to withstand ultraviolet, and so they die.
Your skin, oh yeah, your skin. jumped across for you. Oh, what a thing to do. 'Cause you were all yellow. Myself trying.
Our sun drives the weather, forms the landscape, feeds and fuels, but sometimes destroys the creatures that live upon it, controls their patterns of activity, makes chemicals in the skin that cheer up those who bask in its rays, and for the ancients was the seat of divine authority. Ultraviolet lights not only help cure tuberculosis, but breast cancer too.
Breast cancer, Uganda, Haiti, Swaziland, Mozambique, very, very low in the tropics. The capitals are the far north, Canada and Sweden, and the far south, New Zealand and Argentina. Okay, so a really striking effect. That's breast cancer. That's breast cancer just shown incidence in relation to latitude. Malaysia near the equator, Iceland near the poles, difference in sunshine. Here's the male equivalent, prostate cancer, exactly the same pattern. Okay, well, we can go further than cancer. We can talk about diabetes, type 1 diabetes, which is often thought of being a childhood disease, but it's not. Adults sometimes, quite often, comes on in adulthood. You get exactly the same thing if we look down in the tropics, Barbados and so on, Brazil, Dominica, Sudan, almost none. Sweden, Aberdeen in the UK, Finland, up at 40. Sardinia, rather surprisingly, very high. But down Canterbury, New Zealand, the southern tip of Argentina, exactly the same pattern again. High sunlight, low disease, for a totally different disease, which is diabetes. Multiple sclerosis, the effect is absolutely striking. Here we have the incidence of multiple sclerosis across the world. The redder it is, the more there is. It's sometimes described in Canada now as the Canadian disease, because Canada has the highest rate of MS in the world. Scotland has a 50% higher rate of multiple sclerosis than England does. It's interesting to look at Australia, because Australia is kind of, you know, it's fairly sunny. But what is interesting is, of course, nearly all Australians historically came from Western Europe, mainly from Britain. And you'll see when they move to a sunny climate, even though they've got genes that might predispose them to multiple sclerosis, and there certainly are such genes, the sun saves them to some degree, and they get much less MS than they do, than people do, their ancestors did in their native continent. And in Scandinavia in particular, some very, very large surveys have been carried out on ultraviolet in relation to health, on what we call cohorts of women. Women brought into this cohort, they were brought into this cohort when they were 55, and they were followed for 15 years and asked when they're 55 or older, and followed for 15 years, and asked about their health. And the hope was to investigate the effects of ultraviolet and skin cancer. And they divided these women into three groups. One group of which really liked sunlight. They went to tanning salons in the winter. They had holidays in the Mediterranean during the summer. They went outside a lot. One light was kind of neutral. They just didn't really bother very much. And one group was positively anti-sunlight. They had desk jobs inside. They lived in the far north. They made no effort at all to get any sun. The proportion of people who died in those who avoided sun exposure was much higher than those who had lots and lots of sun exposure. And the biggest effect, there were effects both in cancer and in cardiovascular disease and in other diseases too. So the effect is strong. In fact, the thing which is remarkable is that the difference in death rates between high ultraviolet women and low ultraviolet women was greater than the difference in death rates of smokers and non-smokers. So that's not a small difference. That's a big, big difference. Okay. So it's important, I think, then, to be well aware of the importance of ultraviolet light and sunlight, ultraviolet light and health. So what's happening nowadays? Well, I have to tell you, things are not looking particularly good. The incidence of vitamin D from deficiency in UK children has gone up in the past 15 years by 15 times. It's still quite low, but it's going up and going up fast. And British children now, British teenagers now, go outside for an hour and a half less a day than they did only 10 years ago. And that was, of course, 10 years ago, they didn't have their mobile phones. Now, 70% of British teenagers have got a television in their room, in their bedroom, and so they just spend more and more time out inside. So the proportion of Scottish children who don't go outside is even higher, and across the world, only the children of Chile go outside less than British children do. So we stay in. I have vivid memories in my school days of being kicked out of Whittle Grammar School on Liverpool's left bank, the Whittle Peninsula. Even when it was icy, we were kicked out for a good hour a day. And we thought this was just to allow our teachers to smoke their pipes. And in fact, it was exactly this feeling that you had to be out in the sunlight, which was good for you.
We cannot look at our moon and sun and not think how interdependent we are. Our brightest star, the sun, is filled with unexpected connections between the need to stay cool and man's ability to stand upright, between the power of memory and the onset of darkness. Animals, plants and human beings need the flow of solar energy to flourish and recreate. I'm Katerina Badzaiki. Join us next week to indulge the curiosity of our curious minds in another of our Infinite Curious programs. In the meantime, aim to expose yourselves to sunlight a few minutes a day and hopefully now gaze and connect to our night sky under a different light. Acknowledge that its distant, non-gravity, oxygenless beauty is a life saviour much closer to us than we think.
Love. beautiful art. 'Cause everybody's changing and I don't feel right. Slowly it's in time. Try to understand that I'm trying to make a move.
Come on.